Yeah, we're getting ready to start chapter 11 of Chronicles. And let's see, I didn't keep one for myself.
You got a big one. Yeah, but don't have a backup.
Okay.
No, we're just here.
Don't get it upside down. I got one.
On the back of it, just to keep things in perspective, I put this timeline on the back. We're in the time period of David. And if you look, and this is a time period of human history from Adam up to current time. If you look at the period that we're covering right now, is right around year 1000. Right around year 1000. So, just for perspective, it's right in the middle of human history. Right in the middle of human history from Adam to current days. King David. So I thought that might help us a little bit to get a perspective of where we're at in history. On the front, we're at the end of Saul's reign, and we're getting into David's reign in chapter 10, 11, 12 today. We finished chapter 10 last Sunday. David had been anointed king quite a few years ago, but he didn't assume the throne. Because Saul was still in power. And the personality of David and his relationship with God would not allow David wouldn't allow himself to take the throne so long as Saul was sitting on the throne, because Saul was God-appointed king. And David's attitude was, whenever God gets ready for me to ascend to the throne, he'll make it happen, and not until then. So even though David was anointed king, and he was in Saul's court, and he had all kind of political support, David was not going to try to take over the rule of Israel so long as Saul was sitting on the throne. Saul was jealous of David. He had sent David out in battle. David had come back victorious. The people had cheered David and said that he was a better warrior than Saul. Saul got jealous. And he was constantly after David trying to kill him. But David kept running away. He didn't fight. Kept running away from Saul. Protected himself when he had to protect himself. Fought with Saul when he had to fight with Saul. But other than that, he tried to stay out of his way. And then last Sunday in chapter 10, I believe it was, we saw where Saul had his final battle. He was killed by the Philistines. And even then, David didn't ascend to the throne of Israel. And we'll see today how it plays out. There was still, I don't believe it's in here, there's still a descendant of Saul, Ishbosheth, one of his sons that was left, who ascended to the throne of Israel in place of Saul. So still, David did not try to usurp that authority. He waited, just waited. Anyway, last Sunday we had talked about Saul's last battle and the people in Jabesh Gilead going to recover Saul's body from the Philistines to give it a decent burial. And we're getting ready to start in chapter 11. Now again, on the chart here, we are about right here, I guess, if you look at yours, about 10:10 is about where we're at right now in the time period. And we'd said last Sunday that the First and Second Chronicles was written way after the fact. It was probably written by Ezra somewhere down here around after the return from Babylon, somewhere around 500 to 450 BC, somewhere around in there probably is written. It's written to fill in some of the blank spaces in the history of 1st and 2nd Samuel and 1st and 2nd Kings. So when we're reading this, just remember that that this is written years later after it actually happened. And Ezra had access to historical records, he had access to official records, he had access probably to some journals from people and so forth, and he pulled out parts of these different documents that he mentions in some places in here to write Chronicles. We sort of skipped over about the first 9 chapters. There's a lot of genealogy in there. And we said one of the reasons for the genealogy is for give the people a sense of history when they're going back into the land. Where'd they come from? Because they've been in Babylon for 70 years. And if we're in Babylon for 70 years, you have to think that the majority of them had never been to Israel. And they didn't realize how the land had been divided up by God in different tribes. And they need to know their genealogy so they can trace themselves back to their tribes to have a sense of history, where they belong when they go back to the promised land. Another reason we didn't talk about last Sunday for that genealogy is you have some genealogy in there for King David. And the Messiah is supposed to be a relative of King David from his genealogical tree. The Messiah is coming from the family of David. So, to identify the Messiah, you got to be able to identify if he's from the lineage of David. So that helps too, have that lineage and have that genealogy of King David there in the first part of Chronicles. Okay, starting in chapter 11. Then all Israel gathered together to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, even when Saul was king, it was you that led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord your God said to you, 'You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over my people Israel.'" So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron. And David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord. And they anointed David king over Israel according to the word of the Lord by Samuel. Okay, Hebron is down here. We have Jerusalem up here. So Hebron was sort of in the middle or in the central part of the Judah. And David came from a tribe of Judah. What tribe did Jesus come from?
Jesus.
Remember the songs we sing out in the sanctuary? One of the lines is a lion of the tribe of Judah. That's another name for the Messiah, Jesus Christ, the lion of the tribe of Judah. So yeah, David is from the tribe of Judah. And Jesus' worldly genealogy takes him back to the tribe of Judah, to King David. So David went down to Hebron. Now Jerusalem is still occupied by the Jebusites right now. They don't belong to the Israelites at all. It's still an occupied city by the original inhabitants. So David made his capital down at Hebron. So all the tribes of Israel send representatives down here to Hebron to anoint David king. Verse 4. And David and all Israel went to Jerusalem, that is Jebus, where the Jebusites were, the inhabitants of the land. The inhabitants of Jebus said to David, "You will not come in here." Nevertheless, David took the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. David said, "Whoever shall smite the Jebusites first shall be chief and commander." And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, went up first. So he became chief. And David dwelt in a stronghold. Therefore it was called the city of David. And he built the city around about from the Milo in complete circuit. And Joab repaired the rest of the city. And David became greater and greater, for the Lord of hosts was with him. The city of Jerusalem had not been able to be conquered. Saul couldn't conquer it. Joshua didn't conquer it. There's some history that I don't know how good the history is that I've read, that they may have been some kind of covenant or promise between the Jebusites and Abram or Abraham that they would always keep the city. I don't know about that. I just read it in one place. But for whatever reason, the city of Jerusalem had never been taken. It was a fortified city. It had a thick wall around it. And nobody had been able to conquer it. And basically, the Jebusites just thumbed their nose at David and said, you ain't taking this city. And it would have been very difficult to take the city because of the big walls they had around the city. And the city was on a hill, too. And I don't know how accurate it is, but a lot of the scholars think that the way that David took the city was he went through a tunnel, aqueduct, or whatever, a place where water went into the city. He went up that and got inside the city intact from within inside.
Why was he going to take it?
Why did he want that city?
Get tax money off of it.
He wanted that city because it was a stronghold. He wanted that as his stronghold. You know, it's military tactics. You're not supposed to leave the enemy in your rear, you know, when you go through. The modern day tactics, sometimes you do that, but then you're supposed to go back and clean up the places you left. So this city of Jerusalem is right in the middle of Israel here. And it's the Canaanites, and they were supposed to have been driven out of the land a long time ago. God told them to. Now, the city of Jerusalem, of course, we know nowadays it's a holy place to Christians, to Jews, and to Muslims. Well, Abraham, that is where Abraham attempted to offer Isaac as a sacrifice. And he was stopped. And God provided a ram in place of the sacrifice. But Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son based on what God asked him to do. Now, God didn't allow him to carry through with it because human sacrifice is an abomination to God. But when God asked Abraham to do that, Abraham's thought was, if God asked me to do it, He's going to make a great nation out of Isaac. If I kill Isaac, God is capable of resurrecting him. Anyway, he attempted to offer Isaac on an altar at the same site that Jerusalem is. And they think it may be at the exact spot where the temple is. Anyway, it was a significant place in Israelite history too. But it was a fortified city, and David wanted it as his fortified city. Now, David was king. Everybody's saying it. David's king now. But and when David goes into battle against the Jebusites to take the city, he makes an offer. Whoever leads in a battle, goes in there first and takes a city, he's going to be my general. He's going to be in charge of my army. And Joab steps up for the job. And he goes in and he takes the city. So Joab becomes David's general. And we'll see Joab, well, we have seen Joab in the First and Second Kings, I think. First Kings, I don't know. He was a general for David throughout. And Joab was a very loyal general to David. Now, who was Joab? What relation was Joab to David besides just his general? Blood relationship. Let's go back and look at 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 16. 1 Chronicles 2, 16. This is another reason we need genealogy. 1 Chronicles chapter 2, verse 16. It's talking about David's family. Verse 15 says, Ozim the sixth, David the seventh, that's the seventh son, and their sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. The sons of Zeruiah, Abishai, Joab, and Ashahel 3. So Joab was David's nephew. His nephew. He's making his nephew general. Not because he's his nephew, but because he goes in and takes the city. Now, if you look at those three names besides Joab, those other names are going to show up too. That gives you a little bit of flavor in the Bible when you know the relationships between these people. It tells us who he is, the son of Zeruiah, but we are not familiar with who David's sisters are. But we can go back and look in genealogy and see relationship. So this is David's sister's son that he's making general. And that's probably a good reason why Joab was so loyal to David throughout his whole kingship and generalship. Joab was always looking after the best interest of David. You can get that kind of stuff from family where you don't get it from just other people sometimes. Okay, verse 10. He took the city. The word Milo. That is a place, but it also means ramparts. And they said from the Milo and complete circuit. So, in other words, he repaired the ramparts all the way around the city. Whatever damage they did in taking the city, they repaired all that to make it a better stronghold for David. And they made it David's capital and called the city of David. Still called the city of David. Okay, verse 10. Now these are the chiefs of David's mighty man who gave him strong support in his kingdom together with all Israel to make him king according to the word of the Lord, according to Israel. This is account of David's mighty men. Ashobiam, a Hakmonite, was chief of the three. He welded his spear against 300 whom he slew at one time. Some guy, huh? Next to him among the three mighty men was Eleazar, the son of Dodo, the Ahohite. He was with David at Pasdamin when the Philistines were gathered there for battle. There was a plot of ground full of barley, and the men fled from the Philistines. But he took his stand in the midst of the plot and defended it and slew the Philistines, and the Lord saved them by a great victory. Another guy. Everybody else is running away. He stands his ground and holds Philistines. Okay, verse 15. Three of the 30 chief men went down to the rock to David at the cave of Adullam, where the army of the Philistines were encamped in the valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold, and the garrison of the Philistines was then at Bethlehem. And David said longingly, "Oh, that someone would give me water to drink from the well of Bethlehem, which is by the gate." Then the three mighty men broke through the camp of the Philistines and drew water out of the well of Bethlehem, which was by the gate, and took it and brought it to David. But David would not drink of it. He poured it out to the Lord and said, "Far be it from me before my God that I should do this. Shall I drink the lifeblood of these men? For at the risk of their lives, they brought it. Therefore, he would not drink it." These things did the three mighty men. Okay, this is the kind of loyal followers David had. David just had a desire. He didn't tell anybody to do it. "I would just like to have a drink of water out of that well in Bethlehem. I know I can't. The Philistines occupy the city. Ain't no way we can go down there and, you know, run them off." These three guys hear David, you know, just, I don't know, daydreaming about having some water out of the well, and they get together and say, "Let's go get him some." And they fight their way down there and fight their way back and bring him some water. Now you see similar kind of things nowadays. You know, I still work for the Army, and the general says, "Wouldn't it be nice if we had that tree cut down?" Next thing you know, that tree's gone. The general didn't want you to cut it down, really. He's just saying, "Well, it's soaring away a little while." And it's gone. And those kind of things are dangerous, you know. When a general's saying something, he better be careful what he says. Because somebody's going to get wind of it, and somebody's going to do it. Whether he really wants it done or not. And they may not do it the way he wants it done, you know. They may pull people off one job and put them over on another job just to get something done because they heard the general say they wanted to do it. And then there's other people that's come around and said, well, the general said, and then they throw out something. The general probably never said that. But they throw those kind of things out trying to expedite something, certain projects getting done. But this is the way it was with David. He was just daydreaming about, you know, wishing he probably occupied Bethlehem so he could, you know, get water out of the well anytime he wanted to. And here are these three guys. This is the kind of guys that are following David. Whatever his desire is, they're going to do it. That's the kind of people you want with you. David's got them. Okay, verse 20. Now, Abishai, the brother of Joab. So if he's the brother of Joab, who is he? Another nephew. Yeah. Now, Abishai, the brother of Joab, was chief of the 30. And he welded a spear against 300 men and slew them, and won a name beside the three. He was the most renowned of the 30 and became the commander, their commander. But he did not attain the three. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was a valiant man of Kabzeel, a doer of great deeds. And he smote two Ariels of Moab. He also went down and slew a lion in a pit on a day when snow had fallen. And slew an Egyptian, a man of great stature, 5 cubits tall. The Egyptian had in his hand a spear like a weaver's beam. But Benaiah went down to him with a shaft and snatched the spear out of the Egyptian's hand and slew him with his own spear. These things did Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and won a name besides the three mighty men. He was renowned among the 30, but did not attain to the three. And David set him over his bodyguard. Another guy. Now this translation I got, it says two Ariels, and it's got a footnote saying they don't really know what it is. I tried to look that up, and other translations have sons of Ariel of Moab. Another translation has lion-like men. So there's several different translations of that. It's not clear, but Talmud says it was three strong noble men of Moab. So whatever it was, you know, it was something that he did that was outstanding, that wasn't expected says smoke these two Ariels. And can you imagine a lion being in a pit and you jumping in there with him to kill him? Ain't no way. Anyway, I was going to get down there with him, but here it says this guy did. Jumps down there and kills him in a pit. And the Egyptian, 5 cubits tall. Anybody got any idea how tall that is?
7.5 feet.
Yeah, somewhere around there. 7.5 to 8 feet. Depends on how you measure your cubics. Big guy. And he jerks his spear out of his hand and kills him. So he had some pretty good guys with him as king. Now David wasn't a slouch either. You know, he's years ago when he was a little boy, he killed Goliath. So David had his own heroic things too. Okay, the next part. The mighty men of the armies were, and I'm not going to read all that because that's a bunch of names hard for me to pronounce for the rest of the chapter. But it lists all these names in the Bible. And even though sometimes it's difficult to read all these names, it's still beneficial a lot of times to go back and find out what relationship they are to people or what position they held. And part of, you know, here these guys are mighty men of David. Their names in the Bible for all of history. Okay, any comments on chapter 11? Getting ready to go into 12 now. Okay, now these are the men who came to David at Ziklag, where he could not move about freely because of Saul the son of Kish, and they were among the mighty men who helped him in war. They were bowmen who shoot arrows and sling stones with either right or left hand. Now that's important, being ambidextrous, whatever, be able to do it both ways. Because certain ways, when you throw the sling or rock, it's like being left and right-handed golfer, you know. You know, when you hit the ball, if you have a tendency to slice, it goes the same way. But if you use a left-hand golfer and he has a tendency to slice, it goes the other way. So being able to do left or right when you're slinging these stones is a big benefit. So he's got the best guys they are in his army here. And he's got all those listed. I'm not going to read all those names either. Verse 8, from the Gadites there were over David's stronghold in the wilderness mighty and experienced warriors, expert with shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and they were swift as gazelles upon the mountains. And lists some guys there. Verse 14, the Gadites were officers of the army, lesser over 100 and greater over 1,000. These are the men who crossed the Jordan in the first month when it was overflowing all its banks and put to flight all those in the valley to the east and the west. They wasn't expecting these guys to cross the river, and they still crossed. Verse 16. And some of the men of Benjamin and Judah came to the stronghold of David. David went to meet them and said to them, "If you've come to me in friendship to help me, my heart will be knit to you. But if to betray me to my adversaries, although there is no wrong in my hands, then may the God of our fathers see and rebuke you." Then the Spirit came upon Amasai, chief of the 30, and he said, "We are yours, old David, and with you, old son of Jesse. Peace, peace to you and peace to your helpers, for your God helps you." Then David received them and made them officers of his troops. Some of the men of Manasseh deserted to David when he came with the Philistines for the battle against Saul, yet he did not help them. For the rulers of Philistines took counsel and sent him away, saying, "At peril to our heads, he will desert to his master Saul." As he went to Ziklag, these men of Manasseh deserted to him. And it's got some names listed there. When David was running from Saul, and this story is back in the earlier chapters recovered several months ago, maybe a year or so ago, when he's running from Saul, David's life was in very much danger. And he went so far as going over to the enemy side, went to the Philistine side for protection. And the Philistines were going to go into battle against Saul. And the Philistine king trusted David. Now David wasn't very trustworthy on the Philistine side because he's been doing stuff behind the king's back. But the king trusted David. But the king's advisors didn't. So they convinced the Philistine king to send David back home and not let him go into battle with them, because they thought if David went into battle with the Philistines against Saul, that in the middle of the battle David would change sides and assault him in the rear. So the Philistine king's advisors were smart not to let David stay there. I don't know how it would have played out, because David did not look to go into battle with Saul. Okay, 21. They helped David against the band of raiders, for they were all mighty men of valor and were commanders of the army. For from day to day, men kept coming to David to help him until there was a great army like an army of God. Somehow David just attracted all these people. Even when Saul was still king, all these warriors saw something in David so far as leadership and so far as his relationship with God that attracted them to David. Now, Saul had that kind of following in the beginning, but Saul turned away from God. And when he turned away from God, his trouble just kept compounding. Okay, 23. These are the numbers of the divisions, the armed troops who came to David in Hebron to turn the kingdom of Saul over to him according to the word of the Lord. The men of Judah bearing spear and spear, 608 6,800 armed troops. Of the Simeonites, mighty men of valor for war, 7,100. Of the Levites, 4,600. The prince Jehoiada of the house of Aaron, and with him 3,000. And it goes on listing, I'm not going to read all that, the different tribes who came and how many men they had with him. So he had a pretty big army, volunteer army. He didn't draft these guys. They were all volunteers going to David to help David and hoping to make David king. 38. All these men of war arrayed in battle order came to Hebron with full intent to make David king over all Israel. Likewise, all the rest of Israel were of a single mind to make David king. And they were there with David 3 days, eating and drinking, for their brethren had made preparation for them. And also their neighbors from as far as Issachar and Zebulun and Naphtali came bringing food on asses, on camels, on mules, and on oxen, abundant provisions of meal, cakes of figs, clusters of raisins, and wine, and oil, oxen, and sheep. For there was joy in Israel. So all these places that talk about Naphtali, farthest tribe away, all these people, even the ones that couldn't go with the warriors down to David in Hebron, they sent provisions to take down there to celebrate David becoming king of Israel. And this is a basically a universal show of support from all the tribes for David to be king. That's what somebody's looking for when they're a leader. They're looking for all this support. They can't do anything if they don't have all this support. Whatever job you're in, you have to have support of all your Indians. You can't be the chief unless all your Indians support you. And David has that. Okay, any questions on chapter 12? Comments?
Does anybody know about how many tribes is living in Israel today?
Supposedly, people from all the tribes are. Now, they talk about the 10 lost tribes. But when the kingdom split, you know, the kingdom basically split right here with the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. And when the kingdom split, the northern kingdom went into idolatry and the southern kingdom basically continued worshiping the true God. And from our studies, earlier chapters, we see where there were people that were in the southern kingdom that wanted to worship idols. They moved north. And as people in the north that want to worship the true God, they moved south. So even though the northern kingdom was carried off in bondage and basically disappeared, that don't mean all those tribes disappeared. Some descendants of those tribes were living down south in Judah. I read something. I don't know where I read it. Read something just this week about some Jews in India. And I can't remember the name of them. But they claim to be descendants of one of the sub-tribes of Manasseh, I believe. They claim to be descendants of a sub-tribe of Manasseh that had ended up in India, you know, years ago. And they had documentation that could trace back so far. And they petitioned Israel to allow them to immigrate to Israel. I think around 2,000 people. And Israel said, we'll allow you to do that, providing you are Jewish, you know, convert to Jewish. Judaism. And these 2,000 people converted to Judaism, and Israel paid for their move back to Israel.
Living in India, were they Buddha or Muslim?
I don't think it said what they were. The article I read, somehow they got away from it, or maybe they were a flavor of it or something like that. I don't know. But they had a desire to go back to their homeland because they had been told throughout their history that they were the descendants of the tribe of Manasseh, and that's where they belonged, and these 2,000 people wanted to go back home. They petitioned Israel, and Israel said, so long as you convert to Judaism, we'll bring you back. And they did, and they brought them back. I wish I'd printed out that article. I didn't think it'd come to mind again, though. But I just read that this week.
Israel, is it on both sides of the Jordan now, today?
Yeah, I wish I had a map of it. Well,
I can't remember the word.
It is. Well, part of it is. Basically, on the east side of the Jordan is the country of Jordan.
Yeah.
On the east side of Jordan, all up in here is Jordan. They took some of the Golan Heights up here, and of course the West Bank is about, let's see, the West Bank, about around, like around in there, that used to, they took possession of it in the last war, I think. There's a joke I've heard, well, not a joke really, but people talking about the West Bank, and they want Israel to give back the West Bank to the Palestinians, you know. Well, when they're talking about the West Bank, some Christian says, which West Bank are you talking about? This is the scope of David and Solomon's kingdom. And right here is the Euphrates River. And the joke is, which West Bank do you want us to give back? You know, this West Bank up here is Iraq. And down here is, where's Damascus? I don't know. Where's that? I don't know where it's at. Somewhere down here. But this is Euphrates River. King.
Right in the middle.
Yeah, right here. See, modern day Israel's like right there. But King David's... not David, but Solomon. I think David went about right here. Solomon pushed it on his father. Solomon pushed it all the way up to the Euphrates River. So, which West Bank are you talking about? Some people say, this is the West Bank here. West Bank of Euphrates. Not down here, West Bank of Jordan. So, if Israel pushed out to their borders back in David and Solomon's rule, it'd take up several countries. They're just the land mass they got nowadays is just a shadow of their glory days. Chapter 13. David consulted with the commanders of thousands, of hundreds, with every leader. And David said to all the assembly of Israel, if it seems good to you, and if it is the will of the Lord our God, let us send abroad to our brethren, who remain in all the land of Israel, and with them to the priests and Levites in the cities that have pasture lands, that they may come together to us. Then let us bring again the ark of our God to us, for we neglected it in the days of Saul. All the assembly agreed to do so, for the thing was right in the eyes of the people. So again, we see the kind of leader David is. He's not making a decision himself. He's going into all the land, talking to all the leadership, and getting a consensus from all the people for support. And what he's wanting to do, he's wanting to move the Ark of the Covenant. And basically, what happened is when Saul fell out of favor with God, he got farther and farther from a relationship with God. And it got to a point that when David was fleeing from Saul, that the priest helped David, unwittingly helped David, because David said that he is on a mission of the king. And when Saul found out the priest helped David, he slaughtered him. So there's a big neglect for the, what do you call it, tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant. People, because Saul had killed the priests, people were sort of leery about being associated with it. So it had fallen into neglect. David wants to change that. He wants to put it back in a position of status where it should be. And he's talking about taking it to Jerusalem. Okay, verse 5. So David assembled all Israel, from Shihor of Egypt to the entrance of Hamath, to bring the Ark of God from Kiriath Jehoram, which belongs to Judah, to bring up the ark of God, which is called the name of the Lord, who sits enthroned upon the cherubim. And they carried the ark of God upon a new cart from the house of Abinadab, and Uzzah and Ahio were driving the cart. And David and all Israel were making merry before God with all their might, with strong with song and lyres and harps and tambourines and cymbals and trumpets. And when they came to the threshing floor of Chidon, Uzzah put out his hand to hold the ark, for the oxen stumbled. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against Uzzah, and he smote him because he put forth his hand to the ark, and he died there before God. And David was angry because the Lord had broken forth upon Uzzah, and the place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of God that day, and he said, "How can I bring the ark of God home to me?" So David did not take the ark home into the city of David, but took it aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, and the ark of God remained in the household of Obed-Edom in his house 3 months. And the Lord blessed the household of Obed-Edom and all that he had. Now, how do you feel about that? David's trying to move the God's ark to Jerusalem to put it in a place of prominence. And as they was taking it on a new cart pulled by oxen, you know, you hit a bump or whatever, and this guy that's walking along beside it thinks he's going to fall off, and he stops it, holds it from falling off the cart, and God zaps him. How do you feel about that? Right. Even though David was trying to do something he thought was good, he wasn't doing it the way God had directed it be done. God's ark was supposed to be carried by Levites on poles, not on a cart. That's not the way God said to carry his ark. That's showing, I guess in a way, showing dishonor to God by not following God's commands. And Uzzah, even though he is trying to do something good, because it the whole action was not, in compliance with God's will, he fell in as part of that, and he died as the result of it. I think we as Christians can try to do some good things, but the way we try to do the good things is probably in the wrong way. It's probably not pleasing to God, maybe.
We do it our way.
We want to do it our way.
Right.
These that die in...
Boil it down to that.
Doing something good is not... That's the first step. But that's not really that terrible.
Well,
it is with the view of the ones
that
are still here.
We all face a first death.
Right.
We all of us face a first death.
Right.
And it's the second death we really got to worry about.
Right.
If you get down to it, my definition of death in the Bible is separation. Physical death is separation from our physical body. And the second death is possible after the judgment. And that is separation from God in hellfire. So the Bible tells us, don't worry about the first death. Worry about the second death. So anywhere where you read death in the Bible, if you sort of think about separation, sometimes it makes more sense, being separated. Separated from your physical body, separated from God, whatever. I use that to even explain some of the old Levitical laws. That if your son dishonors you, you put him to death. Put him to death. We can still do that nowadays. If you look at death, definition being separation. You know, if you have a son or a relative or a family member or whatever that's into drugs and are constantly stealing things from you and so forth, and put them to death. Just separate yourself from them. Put them to death. And some of the Orthodox religions, they practice that. You know, a person say, "I don't have a son. He's dead." You know, he chose to do a certain thing. I put him to death. Don't have a son anymore.
Can't put him to death. Well, that to me, that's separation from life. Breathing life. When you speak the word death.
That's our worldly human definition of death is a physical death. There's other kind of deaths, though. There's spiritual deaths. And in the Ten Commandments says you will not. Some translation says you will not kill, but the correct translation, you will not murder. In other words, you won't put a person to death on purpose. And we take that to mean a physical death, killing somebody physically. But a worse sin, I think, if you can rank sin, is killing somebody spiritually. We can kill somebody spiritually. Put them to death spiritually. Separate them from God. And I think that's worse than physical killing a person. Anyway, we'll pick up around the end of chapter 13, 14 next Sunday. Let's close with a word of prayer. Gracious Heavenly Father, we pray that you'll continue to unfold your word before us. Have us to know your will that we may follow it. As we go into sanctuary now, Lord, we pray all our words and deeds will be to glorification of your name. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.